This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to the Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin and with me, Ibrahim Sunny. How are you this morning, Ibrahim?
Hey, good morning. This morning, I'm actually quite excited about the whole day. Largely because...
I mean, well beyond the Morning Run.
Well beyond the Morning Run, obviously. Yeah.
Okay, so today on the Breakfast Grill, we have Yuvarajan Yuvarajan, as it were, CEO of XBIT Asia. And he's going to be speaking to Julian, that is, about XBIT, which is an exchange platform for the trading of bitcoins. And of course, for someone like me, bitcoins remains a kind of a bit of a mystery. I kind of understand the principles, I don't understand why people believe in it.
Right. I think the larger debate here is on a cryptocurrency. And of course, that is, of course, another subset of blockchain. And I think I can understand why, it's a mystery for you, because I don't think we have ever had a person actually explaining it in the simplest fashion of what this is and why this is more important than paper money, right? And we're going to interview a particular guest that can actually break it down to that simplest form next week. And hopefully, at least for this morning, XBIT Asia, through Yuvarajan, he could explain that as well.
Well, but it's not more important than paper money, not at least at this point anyways. I mean, paper money still, as you like to call it, that it still rules, isn't it?
Not so in Singapore and Sweden, because interbank exchanges, meaning banks, when they pay each other in Singapore, they already pay in blockchain and they already pay, they're already phasing out the paper money portion. So at least for countries like Singapore and Sweden, they are one step ahead of other countries.
All right. Interesting. So I look forward to this Breakfast Grill because, bless you. Kasun tight, as they say in Tamantun, because I would really like to learn more about how this operates and whether it's going to change the way in which we do business and live our lives. On current affairs today, which comes after the 8:30 news, so Breakfast Grill, of course, is from 8 to 8:30, and then after the bulletin, we have a segment looking at current affairs. We're going to be looking at a series of articles that were published in The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, last month, about migrant workers in Malaysia and how they're mistreated.
Okay, so this is a big story for both the brands in question, which is Samsung and Panasonic, because of the fact that they've been accused of mistreating foreign migrant workers in one of the factories in Port Klang. Up until then, Samsung and Panasonic has come out to defend themselves, saying that they are upholding all the best practices in labor laws of the land. But I think the investigation that has been brought to light by The Guardian last month in the UK still comes to show that despite the reassurances that Samsung and Panasonic has given, people are still questioning their methods.
Yeah, so, okay, so there's also, I mean, questioning also has to be applied to the newspaper itself, right? I mean, we can't assume that the newspaper got it right. But to the extent that they did, I mean, when I read the piece on Port Klang, I actually was traveling in Bangladesh, and it was quite interesting for me because it was forwarded by a friend of mine who lives in Kathmandu, and he said, you know, oh, have a look at this. And it was interesting as a story because, you know, what it did suggest is that, you know, sort of economic desperation on the part of some segments of Nepali society pushed them into the hands of these exploitative agents. But the exploitative agents are only there because they are people who are desperate enough to forego or overlook their own self-interest. And, you know, and then a lot of intermediaries, you know, agencies who could perhaps intervene on the behalf of the worker also doesn't seem to operate. So, yeah. The Nepali government doesn't seem to be that interested.
For it.
Yeah, and because, you know, say, for instance, there's misrepresentation of the kind of salaries they're going to get. And what in the story that's told about this particular Nepali worker, he basically gets himself into a cycle of debt, which seems unending. It, you know, it's like, and this is what the somewhat clickbait-like headline read, you know, bonded labor.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, so what could be done? I mean, could you just persuade people not to leave their own countries and put themselves at risk? You know, what kind of public education needs to be done in the sending countries? And what kind of sanctions, you know? And but then the question is, even if there was that kind of information, would people still avail themselves of the services of these agents? I mean, you know what
because
I mean?
At the end of the day, the real consumers would be the buyers of these products and brands, right? And I think if there is no buyers of, say, Samsung and Panasonic, then there would be a need.
No. I'm talking about the labor situation, because what Samsung and Panasonic are, and all these big companies do, is they often have subcontractors. And this is where the violations are going on. They're going on with the subcontractors, not with the main. So these big companies often have those labor standards. And, you know, and we know, of course, in one of the instances resulting from one of these Guardian reports, is that the subcontractor was sacked. I mean, was, you know, relieved of their duty because of their inability to comply with labor laws. So I'm not talking about the product. I mean, we all want handphones and whatnot. The issue really is the economic desperation of people who put themselves at risk because they need to find money. And they think that, you know, going overseas is going to be, you know, kind of the way of out of poverty at home.
Have you ever met anyone of these individuals where he or she was subjected to these kind of harsh working conditions?
Yeah, I mean, I have over the years. Yeah, because I talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite Indian restaurants, you know, gives 4 hours a week off to their workers. So every 2 weeks they get a day off. And, you know, and yeah, and the person has, you know, I was told of other rather troubling practices, but I couldn't verify it, right? So physical abuse by the owner or owner's son or whatever. And these things happen, right, in my favorite Indian restaurant. And but think of it, you know, if you were given just a day off every 2 weeks, I mean, how medieval is that, right? You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be medieval. You just go back a century and you already have those kind of conditions.
Yeah,
and you see it all over the country. And what kind of monitoring is done for all those workers in our mama stalls, you know, and, you know, do their respective governments care about their labor, their situation, and do they intervene, more importantly? And how corrupt is the system of enforcement that allows, you know, these kinds of violations to carry on? Yeah. Have you met people?
Yeah, actually, Nepali in particular. So I think I would like to tune in to this particular show of ours to see where this conversation can lead us to. And this is coming after the 8:30 news this morning.
That's right. And later in the morning, as we kind of round up the morning run, we have the BBC as usual on Tuesday. And it looks at the Italian banking crisis. And that's caused quite timely, considering that Italy went for the referendum over the weekend. And one of the issues, of course, with that country is institutional paralysis.
Yeah, of course. But it's worth noting that this show was recorded shortly before the Italian referendum. So they're still unaware of the results coming in from the referendum vote yesterday.
Yeah, but of course, you know, and this is some of the critics of Matteo Renzi saying that, you know, his political reforms were just one step in what would have had to be in a, you know, multi-pronged approach to Italy's problems. You know, it's not just, it's the banking system, it's their stock exchange, it's the way in which, you know, Italy, a lot of Italian businesses haven't caught up with the digital revolution. There was a piece in The Economist, you know, recently saying how a particular company that has over a turnover of some 30 million euros, still puts all its logistical information and manages all its logistical information on a whiteboard.
Mm.
You know, they haven't moved to a computer system, a computerized system, in order to deal with their logistics.
I just don't understand why that's the case, right? Because just north of them, it's very advanced. Germany is extremely advanced. France is extremely advanced in terms of digital revolution.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely no reason in terms of the flow of technology, their ability. They're a rich country, right? It's just a question of inertia. And I think that's what they're suggesting. There is, in fact, quite a bit of inertia, plus a political paralysis that's not allowed for, you know, sort of a nimble government, a strong central government that can push through reforms and can enable change in that country. And Matteo Renzi's proposal was knocked down partly because of, you know, historical whatever memories of dictatorship. And so there was this feeling that you don't want to give the executive that kind of control. You don't want to put so much power in the hands of the central government. And as a consequence, Italy will continue in the way that it does until we see an election. And then we see whether Italy will precipitate the breakup of the European Union. Is it the five-star movement?
The five-star movement gets
the largest share of votes.
Led by a comedian, mind you. So
well, yes. A former comedian.
Yeah.
Once
a comedian, always a comedian.
Once some countries get politicians who then turn into comedians.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, so that's another thing altogether. Speaking about show people in politics, Chief Minister of Tamil Nadu, Jayalalitha, is on life support. In fact, I think yesterday the rumors were right that she had died after following a heart attack. She's in her late 60s. And but I think the government of Tamil Nadu has come out to say that, no, she's not dead. She's only on life support at the moment.
Yeah. Of course, The Guardian, of course, carries the story that she has died. So these kind of reports are quite...
Oh, interesting. But I think there was a lot of misinformation. She hadn't been seen in public since September, you know. And the other thing that comes along with this story is that the government of Tamil Nadu is on high alert, which is quite interesting because of a particular kind of political culture. I don't know if this is true of all of India, but it's certainly true of Tamil Nadu, where supporters of politicians resort to self-harm in shows of solidarity with their leaders. So when Jayalalitha was jailed briefly in 2014 for corruption, you know, several people, I believe, committed suicide. And this again, you know, happens, you know, in that country, because there's a kind of cult of personality around individuals.
Yeah.
She of course was linked to the former chief minister of Tamil Nadu, MGR, because he was a big star. You know, to say that he's a film star in the kind of Hollywood sense is to kind of misunderstand what film stars in India can become.
Yeah, they're not, you know.
They're like demigods.
They are demigods. That's the word I'm looking for.
You know, I think there's a local MGR fan club in Malaysia, Ibrahim. And I remember one year I picked up one of their booklets. No, because we could put MGR into the BFM. And, you know, for their Christmas issue, they had the front cover. And it was quite fascinating because they had MGR, as it were, as Jesus Christ on their front cover, you know.
Okay.
I thought it was quite funny. I bought it, though. I don't read Tamil. But
right.
I think what's interesting is to watch what happens if and when she dies. Because all of us die at some point.
Yeah.
So let's see if that causes problems for the state of Tamil Nadu. Also in the news, Ibrahim, the United Nations Special Rapporteur for the Rights to Freedom of Assembly, a peaceful assembly, has come out to congratulate the Malaysian government for its position on the Rohingya issue, but also kind of criticize it for what he suggests is kind of double standards or the lack of application of this principle of solidarity with people who are oppressed and the rights for peaceful assembly in a universal kind of fashion.
Right. So this individual gave the special lecture at the Institute of Integrity in Malaysia in Kuala Lumpur very recently, basically, you know, commending us and, of course, criticizing us at the same time, which is great. I think we should be taking this with a pinch of salt at the end of the day, because after all, we should govern our own nation. But we should be open to ideas as given by other people.
Yeah, also in the news, the Myanmar government says it's going to be issuing an official response objecting to our Prime Minister's involvement in the protests in solidarity with the Rohingya people and pointing to the fact that the Myanmar government has two commissions, one advisory and one investigative, on the Rohingya problem and saying that they are trying to deal with the Rohingya problem in a transparent manner. I believe there's an international commission now on the Rohingya issue that involves Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, but it does not involve any leader or any stakeholder, except the Rohingyas, from Southeast Asia. So there's a curious kind of sidelining of Southeast Asia in this international commission. The question is, what kind of powers will they have, and that will they be able to impress upon the military the need for a different and more a less violent response? So we'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The morning run continues, and that was Knock on Wood by Eddie Floyd. Quick correction. Earlier we were talking about the Chief Minister of Tamil Nadu, Jayalalitha. She has, in fact, passed away. I think the news came out 3 hours ago. After some period of denials about her death, this has been now confirmed, and it's carried in various reports, including the Hindu, which, of course, is one of India's leading newspapers.
It's worth noting that she was dubbed the Iron Lady of Tamil Nadu, perhaps because of her method of dealing with her dissidents, on top of the fact that she is quite headstrong in terms of her governing style.
Yeah, and also, you know, what's really interesting about India's kind of regional politics and how important the regional parties like the IMD, IADMK, I believe, you know, and such have become are to federal politics.
While we're at it, right? I think Narendra Modi might see some need for him to re-engineer his political ties in the Tamil Nadu state, because Jayalalitha, from my readings last night, was a rather strong proponent for some of PM Modi's initiatives. So perhaps he might need some sort of a new ally following her loss.
Okay, so the acronym for the party which she led is the AIADMK. So we'll have probably more news on that later on, as I think this is going to have quite a significant effect on Indian politics. But we move back to closer to home. Also in the news, very quickly, two highways. There's always a chill runs down my spine every time I read about highways in the country. Damansara Shah Alam Elevated Highway Dash and Sungai Besi Ulu Klang Expressway Suk. The proposals for the taking over of two forest reserves for the construction of these two highways has been submitted to the Selangor Economic Action Council. And that's in the news. And because already, you know, this is where Malaysians sometimes, you know, can be patted on the back for kind of stepping up and getting involved, trying to preserve the environment. So there's, in fact, a association called Say No to Suk. That says it all, I guess.
I wonder what they do.
Yeah. So the representatives who have been arguing against it. I don't know if we do need another highway. I'm not a car driver. I don't know if cutting down driving time by 3 minutes is a sufficient argument for the destruction of the forest.
There's sufficient evidence and study to point out that as long as you have highways, it will be filled up. It's called, the name escapes me. But basically, if you build a 3-lane highway on each side, that means a 6-lane highway, you're going to get it filled up in no time. if you fill it, if you build a 10-lane highway, you're still going to get it filled up. It's just a matter of time. So the question is, it's not about building bigger and stronger and straighter highways. It's about trying to manage the transit and mobility of your people. And that is more important. And that's why when the government, we have to be all critical on the government, right? But when the government introduces interesting new measures for MRT, LRT, railway, these kind of actions should be commended, because at the end of the day, it helps people move about and it moves away from our dependency on having highways
and cars. And I think, you know, those,
precisely.
And it's said about car parks as well. Car parks encourage more cars coming to the city. We need to find solutions. I mean, the destruction of more forest reserves. I mean, you can build a highway, you can tear it down. It doesn't take very much time to do either process. But forest reserves take a long time to develop, and they provide, you know, such a service. I mean, clean air and green, and you know, and yeah, really, and the possibility to breathe in the city. So really, I'd be really heartbroken if they destroy these forests.
It's true. When you say that, you know, forest reserves take a long time. You know, I just watched this particular show called Cosmos, hosted by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it puts things in perspective. Assuming the Big Bang happened on January the 1st, and we're living here on the 31st of December, right? And we compress the entire life of our universe within a 365-day calendar period. Forest reserves actually grew on December 1st. And here we are destroying on December 31st. So this is the problem.
You know, in my neighborhood, the number of times I've seen a big old tree chopped down, I think, how many years did it take for that tree to develop? And then for little in return, I'm not even sure why these trees are chopped down, and then somebody will plant some measly little palm tree in its place. And you think, you know, it's extraordinary our lack of concern about the living environment in which we exist. But anyway, we can talk on and on about that. I do want to go to a story that we had. I thought this would be interesting to discuss with you, Ibrahim, because you have children. You're a father of three. Apparently, this is rather gruesome, though. A U.S. father has been sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole for, and this is what the sentence suggests, deliberately leaving his toddler in a hot car to die. Now, he, of course, came out to say that it was negligence on his part. He just, you know, mistakenly left his son inside. His ex-wife, who divorced him after the incident, testified on his behalf, saying that he was a loving father. But one of the interesting bits in the story, Ibrahim, is that evidence was used against him, evidence that he'd looked at websites advocating a child-free lifestyle. And I thought that's very interesting that, you know, this would, I mean, what is it about a child-free lifestyle that needs advocacy in a blog?
Yeah, and you know, at the end of the day, this guy, as alluded by the prosecutors, kind of shows that he doesn't want to have kids any longer.
So any longer is the point, right? He's already had the child.
And now he's having second thoughts.
So this is what the prosecutor suggested, that he wanted to kill his child because he wanted to pursue other things in his life, including relationships with other women.
And it's rather unfortunate for him to actually undergo through this particular period in time. I would rather, you know, these individuals not have kids in the first place.
Yeah, but what is it? So, okay, you know, you've lived the single life, a life without children, and now that you have children, I mean, you know, could you make a plug for having children? Could you say something nice about having
children? It's not for everyone, I can tell you that.
It's not for everyone.
It's not for everyone.
Okay, so that's interesting, because culturally, the default mode is that everybody should and must have children, right?
In our culture.
It is in our Asian culture.
Asiatic culture, the Southeast Asian kind of upbringing.
Isn't it? And yeah, so what happens when parents, what happens when individuals, couples, feel that they must have children when they're then either not ready or, in fact, not inclined to have children?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the problem here is when societal pressure and family pressure comes into play. At least for me, in my case, I was fortunate enough that my parents and my in-laws were never in a position to impose that kind of pressure on us to have kids. But I'm not. I'm the lucky one. I presume it that way because a lot of people in my peers, for instance, they are still being pressured to have kids, and even when they do have kids, they need to have more kids. If you get so the cycle perpetuates, and
So what would you say to very quickly? What would you say to a parent who says, "Have the child, you'll end up loving them"?
Baby, no, I don't think so. Well, it doesn't work that way.
Okay, it doesn't necessarily work that way. But what works is the first news bulletin of the day, and we're going to have that with Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was I'm Sick of You by Lou Reed. What an appropriate song. For some of us, maybe have less than positive feelings about the people who lead us, whether it's in the office or it's nationally or in any other way, maybe in your neighborhood, you don't like your residence committee. But at any rate, yesterday, Ibrahim, we had, of course, news of the resignation of the Italian Prime Minister following his defeat in the referendum, a referendum he called. That was not the surprise. What was the real surprise was the shock resignation of the Prime Minister of New Zealand, an unforced resignation, unanticipated both by his cabinet, his party, and the nation. So I thought it'd be good to have a look at the whole phenomenon of resignations.
Okay. Before we do that, right, I just want to reel back a few notches, saying, because you did use the example of resident associations. At least for my association, no one wants to be the committee leader and so on, right? And everybody is pushing the other party to become the, president of the resident association and such. Largely because we don't like the work, the additional work that is befallen on us. And I think the same kind of the same kind of responsibility is given to these kind of leaders. Sometimes, if you're not an Asian country, becoming a leader of that particular country, particularly in a first world country, is more of a hassle than a privilege. And
yeah, it's public service, right? So you do something, you make sacrifices, you don't expect to enrich yourself during that period.
Yeah,
you don't expect.
And
you know,
it's a thankless job. Everybody's going to just moan about you, and you're not going to be there. People are just not going to be thankful for you.
Unless you do a good job. And I think the Prime Minister of New Zealand was said to have, he celebrated his 8th anniversary as Prime Minister, John Key, and he was said to have done quite a good job. He'd led his party to successive victories at the polls because of the work that he had done. But he said that he felt that he had nothing more to contribute, that he was bereft of ideas, and that he would rather spend his time with his family, who had suffered, all kinds of intrusions into their private lives because of his position as Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was, it's a curious attitude to hear expressed, especially coming from a region where, we've had one strong man after another, people who really want the position for life. They don't even want it for a couple of terms. Yeah, they do want it for life.
And this affliction is not exclusive just to us here in Malaysia, but our neighbors as well.
Absolutely, in the region, absolutely. There's nothing to be... I don't think Malaysia is very unique in the way in which, people view leadership and how leaders view themselves in that position of leadership.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if it trickles down to the everyday, Ibrahim, whether it trickles down to the way in which businesses are run or NGOs are run. And I, worked in several NGOs. Again, strong leaders.
That's another dimension I haven't seen, actually.
Yeah,
NGO leadership is also afflicted with this whole continuity problem. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are problems in handing over and transition, people being able to let go, protecting your legacy. A lot of NGOs, course, I mean, to be generous to them, I often started by, you know, very idealistic individuals who put a lot of themselves into creating those NGOs. Yeah, and this is where they can let go.
So this is the beauty of it, because many of these institutions, not least political parties and NGOs, but they are just starting out their, you know, their life, you know. I mean, having studied in Australia and I've worked even in the UK, you know, it's not common for you to come across an organization that is 200, 300, 400 years old, right? But for this part of the world, anything that is more than 50 years old, you're already actually quite amazed at how old, you know, quote unquote, that particular organization is. So it's worth noting that we are still a young region. We are still new to institutionalizing things anywhere between NGOs and political parties. But also, it's also worth noting that when you found something, when you create something, or when you're the first president or the first vice chancellor, the first rector of that particular university or whatever, you kind of want to see it through because you have something in your mind and you just want to make it happen. But I think this is the part where people lose track of what an institution is. Sometimes an institution outgrows you, and sometimes the institution needs to grow without you, even though you are the founder of that particular institution.
Yeah, and I agree with you completely. We sometimes do forget how young we are as a nation, and you know, and the institutional resilience we see in other countries that we envy in other countries, sometimes is a function of that
right.
of time. But you know, there are also young countries that have institutions like ours. Say, for instance, you know, the Indian judiciary, and it's an extraordinary institution, and it's held forth against attempts at dictatorship in that nation. And I think it's got to do with the political culture as well. You know,
of course, definitely.
So the respect for the judiciary, whereas we see the judiciary undermined at every turn in so many countries in the region.
There was a show that I was watching, one of the lines that the actress gave was quite striking to me, at least. The actor said, "Never underestimate the strength of the institution, but never underestimate the fight for keeping that institution independent." Because according to that particular actor, he was alluding to the fact that the fight to keep it independent is as strong as organization itself. So the clearest and the simplest argument that I could exemplify this would be on the founder of UMNO, Dato' On Jaafar. Was actually expelled his own party.
Sorry, Dato' On Ben Jaafar.
Dato' On Ben Jaafar. There you go. Sorry, because the other one is an actor who's alive and kicking right now in Damansara Utama, actually. So Dato' On created UMNO, founded UMNO with the royal assent and the royal patent. And it stands until today. But mind you, he was kicked out because he had a change of heart or a change of vision.
Yeah, and then he started
right?
Pati Negara, didn't work.
IMP, that.
But
didn't
work
look,
either. What's really interesting is how countries deal with changing circumstances and whether those institutions have resilience, right? So I wonder about the US. I'm looking at Trump, and Trump has just tweeted out. He's going to conduct diplomacy on Twitter.
Yes.
Which is, and he's already, took that phone call with the president of Taiwan. Mm. What is interesting is that he lied about it. He went on to say that she called him when, in fact, it was a scheduled call, right? So this was prearranged.
Yeah.
And so this is a president who not only lies or misrepresents reality, but then will go on and then,
reality.
Undermine 30 years of diplomatic convention between the US and China,
yeah.
and then engage in a Twitter war.
But you kind of see this coming.
So the question is whether the American institutions will be able to hold themselves or to maintain themselves in the face of what is a very volatile and unpredictable individual.
That's a valid question. However, I'm pessimistic of the outcome. I don't think that the American institutions can actually manage these kind of behavior because he doesn't, one person I spoke to this week, dubbed Trump as a free radical. In physical terms, in physics, that means it doesn't behave.
An orange-colored free radical.
An orange-colored free radical. In physics, it means simply that. It doesn't conform to the regular norm of other particles. And clearly he's behaving in a manner that is as such.
Yeah. So the question again is whether American institutions will be able to withstand the onslaught of a Trump presidency, maybe not just for the 4 years, maybe for the 8 years. It's going to be a long period of America and the rest of us in the world dealing with this unpredictable individual. But we'll have more about that later on. Now we have Sonny and Cher. If you remember Sonny and Cher, you're too young to remember Sonny and Cher.
Sorry about
the beat goes on. The beat. Sonny and Cher. How do you not know them? Oh, what? My goodness. Okay. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.